Hello, and welcome to Power Pros Podcast, Episode 13, Dragon of Destiny. I am one of your co-hosts, the Hoff, Chris Hoffman, and with me is my friend and cohort, Chris Slate.
Hello.
And we are back to talk about Nintendo, and we have a ton of stuff to discuss this week. There's going to be a whole bunch of news to talk about, as well as an anniversary to discuss. So that's going to be our big topic, is the anniversary of the Super Nintendo. So we will get to that shortly.
Yeah, before we get going, I should probably mention that we're using different mics this week. Some of our audio equipment is on the fritz right now. So hopefully this comes through and everything sounds great. If not, we apologize in advance.
We really should be sorry about this. But first, the news. And when it comes to news, there is a whole lot to talk about this week because Nintendo made a big announcement just a couple of days ago, basically discussing their entire roadmap for the rest of 2015, telling us, you know, more or less exactly when everything is going to hit. So, well, why don't we just start with that and start traveling down the list?
Yeah, let's dig in.
And it all begins on September 11th, as we've already been aware. That is when Super Mario Maker comes out, along with the Mario Pixel Amiibos and the Wave 5 Amiibos that haven't already arrived. Of course, those being Dr. Mario, Zero Suit Samus, Bowser Jr., Ganondorf, and Captain Olimar. And in fact, there is a new Wii U bundle that's going to be coming with an Amiibo, and that's exclusive to Walmart. It's got the system, it's got the modern Pixel Amiibo, and it's got Super Mario Maker. So if you haven't got onto the Wii U train yet, this is a wonderful opportunity to do that.
You know, you could just buy that one kit and pretty much get your money's worth out of it if you end up playing Super Mario Maker as much as I think I'm going to play Super Mario Maker over the coming months and probably years.
Yeah, it's basically a game developer's kit for $300.
It's like an SDK.
And this is actually the first official thing we've heard about the blue and red modern Pixel Mario. So I would assume that it is a Walmart exclusive, which has kind of been my hunch for a while now. But I'm also going to assume it's not only going to be in this bundle, because that would be crazy. I think it's more like the regular Mario Party Mario Amiibo that first came out in a bundle and then was released separately carded a very short time afterwards.
Right, and maybe the separate version will still be at Walmart. We'll just have to wait and find out.
Yeah, that would be my hunch. But speaking of exclusive Amiibo, we've learned that a couple of the Amiibo coming out on that date are indeed exclusives. Dr. Mario has been confirmed for sure as a Target exclusive, and it looks like Bowser Jr. is going to be a Toys R Us exclusive. It definitely is in Canada. We would assume it is in North America. We're still waiting the final word, but it seems pretty certain to me that it's going to be that way in North America as well.
So we get the pleasure of having to line up at two different stores on the same day.
Speak for yourself. I've already imported all of mine, so have fun.
You time-traveling bastard.
Of course, I'm going to have to line up to get my Pixel Mario, I suppose, so we'll see how that goes. So then from there, 2 weeks later, on September 25th, we have the release of Animal Crossing Happy Home Designer for the Nintendo 3DS, as well as that being the release date of the Retro Amiibo 3-pack at GameStop.
Which may still be available. I haven't checked lately, have you?
It's funny. It did go away a couple days ago, and then it came back, and I'm not sure what the status is right now. But, if you haven't got it yet, probably ought to check into it now. Sooner the better.
Who would have thought that a 3-pack exclusive to one chain that featuring only some of Nintendo's most, bygone characters would end up being probably the easiest thing to get your hands on?
Well, when you put it that way, I guess it kind of makes sense. But it did seem like it was something that would, sell out in short order.
Mm.
But, that's not too far off. That's less than a month from as we're recording this. And I'm definitely looking forward to getting my hands on those.
Yeah, we're less than 3 weeks away now, I think, from finally having Mario Maker.
Mm-hmm. So then after that, on October 9th, is the release of Chibi Robo Ziplash for 3DS. And supposedly, that's when we'll be getting the bundle with the Chibi Robo Amiibo as well. Although, no place is really allowing you to buy that yet. I actually did put in a pre-order at some place online called, the Nebraska Furniture Mart or something like that.
And they'll be getting the next exclusive.
It could be. And, you know, so I place an online order with them. You know, it'll be like, oh, it's showing up in our Omaha store on, you know, the 10th of October or something like that. I'll have to head out there and pick it up. I don't know. No, supposedly they'll be shipping it to me. Hopefully they're good and they really do sell. But, yeah, it's weird that it hasn't shown up on any, you know, regular national retailer yet, like Amazon or Walmart or Toys R Us or whatever. But, yeah, we will see how that works out for me come October 9th. Then just a week after that, on October 16th, Yoshi's Woolly World finally comes out, along with the three little Yarn Yoshi amiibo, those, you know, being the regular green one that's available in the bundle, as well as separately, the pink one and the blue one. And on top of that, there is a new special game bundle featuring new Super Mario Brothers for Wii U and new Super Luigi U.
Now, that combo pack has existed before as a pack-in, hasn't it? I mean, I know there's been you've been able to buy a Wii U with both games. I don't know if they came on the same disc or if they were both just the digital versions.
Yeah, I can't tell you since you know I never bought the thing that way.
But now you can buy it by itself, huh?
Yeah, if you don't have either of those, or heck, even if you do and you're just a hardcore collector, you'll be able to pick that up in a dual pack on October 16th. Shortly after that, on October 22nd, Fatal Frame, Maiden of Blackwater, we know, is finally hitting. And it's only going to be a downloadable release.
Yeah, the very kind of Japanese folklore-focused horror game coming out here. I guess, you know, it's only a digital release, which is a shame, but at the same time, it's a bit of a surprise we got it at all. So,
yeah, I mean, there was a Wii version of Fatal Frame that never came out over here, so it is cool that we're getting it at all. But, man, I really am not fond of digital only releases on Wii U. It's not really a problem for me with 3DS because I just bought a, you know, memory card that has a high capacity and I can kind of fill it with whatever I want. But, you know, I actually did try getting a hard drive on my Wii U recently and it gave me all kinds of trouble and I kind of had to give up on it. Maybe it was just a terrible brand or something. But, you know, right now it's really hard for me to get full-size games onto my Wii U. So, you know, we'll have to see how this pans out for me. But, yeah. We can take all kinds of ghost pictures come October 22nd. Then the day after that, on October 23rd, we'll be getting Legend of Zelda Triforce Heroes.
Can't wait for that one. It's been a while. It feels like it's been forever since we've had a significant 3DS game.
Well, you say that, but LBX did just come out a couple of days ago.
It feels like it's been forever since we've had a significant 3DS game.
Wow. Harsh, man. Harsh.
I haven't played it yet. You have, though, and we'll get to that in a bit, I imagine.
Yes. But back to the roadmap here. On November 1st, the Mii Amiibo 3-pack comes out. That's with you know, the Brawler, the Gunner, and the Swordsman. What's the Swordsman actually called?
Sword Dude, I think, is the official title.
Then on November 6th, we get Yo-Kai Watch for the 3DS. On November 15th, we get an exciting new addition to the Amiibo lineup, and that is Mega Yarn Yoshi. And this was something they just announced when they put out this press release a couple of days ago, something that no one had known about, but it is a big honkin' Yarn Yoshi, like 7 inches tall, it looks like.
Yeah, he's so big that the patch that is the actual NFC part of the, not figure anymore, a plush animal, I guess
doll,
you call it,
whatever.
Doll, is on his foot. So you can only fit his foot onto the game pad. You know, the rest of him's too big. And he is a different, we should point out, he's, you know, the other Yoshi, the smaller ones are all the same, basically the same toy, but different colors. This one is actually a different kind of pose.
Yeah, you would call it a sculpt if it was, you know, a plastic figure, but it's not. But yeah, this one is standing upright instead of just, you know, sitting down on his keister like the small ones are.
I'm down with him. A part of me feels like they're milking these Yarn Yoshi amiibo a little too much, considering that it's all they're all very similar. But it kind of makes sense that, you know, when you see the little ones, and especially when you see them in person and realize how small they actually are, it's kind of nice to have a big kind of teddy bear-sized Yoshi. Although I do think the price is a little
It's $40, I believe.
Yeah, that's a little crazy.
And that's if you can find it in the store. Knowing, you know, Amiibo prices, you'll be sitting on the secondary market for like $80 or something.
Yeah.
More than you will on an actual store shelf.
And we should point out that that the functionality that he has as an Amiibo is the exact same as the smaller Yoshis. He unlocks the same content in Yoshi's Woolly World.
Yeah. Now, I have to admit, I was a little bit disappointed because as soon as I saw the name Mega Yarn Yoshi, I thought it was going to be Yarn Yoshi in his, you know, Mega Man gear that you, you know, I guess, you know, color scheme, I would say, that you get when you use the Mega Man amiibo in the game. So I'm like, oh, it's just a mega-sized Yoshi. Oh, okay, I guess that's cool. I mean, they really could be going totally nuts and giving you, like, all those different Yarn Yoshi. If they really wanted to milk us, that's what they would do. They'd be like, oh, here's the one you get when you put
Let them. Don't give them any ideas.
You know, oh, they probably thought of it already.
I'm already wondering how I'm going to put Mega Yarn Yoshi on the shelf with my regular-sized amiibo. He'll probably have to, like, sit in the back corner or something, like he's commanding his army of smaller fellows.
Yes, yes, indeed. But, yeah, they could be giving us, you know, Toad-style Yarn Yoshi and Lucina-style Yarn Yoshi and Bowser-style Yarn Yoshi.
You know, one thing this really proves, though, is that looking at the difference in size, they can really put an NFC stamp on anything. I mean, anything technically could be an amiibo.
I'm going to get one embedded in my elbow. I'm going to be an amiibo.
Be the world's first living amiibo. What will you unlock? Pies.
Sounds fine to me. On November 20th, then, 5 days after the Mega Yarn Yoshi, is the release of both Star Fox Zero and Pokemon Super Mystery Dungeon. Plus, that's the release date of the Falco amiibo.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense for, obviously, Falco and Star Fox to
team up. Yeah, I think, you know, if that hadn't been official before, I kind of, you know, felt that was a no-brainer they were going to do.
And a lot of times Nintendo releases, you know, they'll go months without, you know, a big release, and then they'll release two big games on the same day. And I always kind of think that's kind of silly logic. But in this case, it seems like the franchises are different enough, and maybe the audiences are different enough that it's not the worst idea in the world.
Slate, you totally forgot about something else that happens before that in November. Why didn't you bring up the release of the Mewtwo amiibo?
Ah, the Mewtwo amiibo. Well, you know, I can only juggle so many amiibo facts in my head at once.
It's kind of funny, though, that Falco, you know, who's on the original roster, is coming out after Mewtwo, who hits in the middle of the month, I believe, when, you know, he was a DLC character.
It could be that Falco was you know, delayed after Mewtwo just so he could release alongside Star Fox.
Actually, I kind of think that's probably the case.
I would really like to know what the logic is. Like, whoever's making the decisions on the order in which to produce these figures, I'd love to know what factors into that.
I think he just really hates Falco and said, no, Falco, you're going to be dead last. You're going to be the very, very last, you know, in-game Smash character to make it out there.
I can't wait till they hit the bonus content amiibos. I really want that Ryu Smash amiibo.
Yeah, you know, I got this Ryu from, I think it was packed in with like a special edition of Street Fighter 4 or something, and it's perfectly amiibo size. I took a couple pictures of like him trying to fireball, you know, Jigglypuff in the face and stuff like that. But it'll be cool to have an actual authentic amiibo to have up there with the characters. Whew, we're not done yet. On December 4th, Xenoblade Chronicles X comes out.
Finally.
And then on December 11th, Devil's Third, which is both downloadable and retail, will be out.
Yeah, that's kind of surprising, considering that it's, I mean, let's be honest, nobody really expects this game to be a top seller, regardless of how good it is or isn't. That's just kind of the way the market has settled out for Wii U. So it's nice to see Nintendo give it a physical release.
Mm-hmm. And as I said, I'm always, you know, down with physical over digital when it comes to Wii U or almost anything else for that matter. So, yeah, I'm happy about that. And then we've got a bunch of, you know, holiday releases that haven't been given exact dates, but should be out sometime this year. And that includes Animal Crossing Amiibo Festival, Mario Tennis Ultra Smash, and then all of the Animal Crossing amiibo figurines, those being Isabelle, KK Slider, Digby, Tom Nook, Reese, Cyrus, Mabel, and Lottie.
Now, some of those are going to come in combo packs, right?
You know, I haven't been totally keeping up on how this is going to be done in the various territories. In some places, there will be multi-packs. In some places, there will be singles. I don't know if they're going to be both in certain territories or how it's going to work. And, of course, some of them are going to be bundled in with the software, but I think also available separately. It's all a bit confusing to me.
Yeah, I think the ones that come in the combo packs are supposed to also be available as individuals.
Combo breaker!
But I don't know for sure either. We got to get more details on that, hopefully for next week.
Whew. So, yeah, if you're a Nintendo fan and you're going to be buying all that stuff, that's going to pay, or it's going to cost a pretty penny, I would say.
I got to tell you, I really wish that some of this had come out earlier in the year, as we detailed last week.
Yeah, we've been in this huge drought. Now here it comes. Open up the floodgates.
Yeah, but I will say that it's a pretty impressive lineup. I think, you know, up until this point, Nintendo's had one of its driest years I can remember. But from here on out, it seems like they're going to have a very solid showing, especially with key titles like Mario Maker, Star Fox. You know, you even get, even though they aren't the main Animal Crossing games, you get some new stuff in that franchise and a lot of cool amiibo. There's a lot of cool stuff. So, you know, and they, it's spaced out pretty evenly. We get, you know, multiple cool things every month. So, you know, I've been kind of chiding Nintendo for their performance so far this year. So I got to give them credit that it looks like they're, you know, finally getting in a groove here as we head toward the end of the year.
But guess what?
What?
There's still more. There are actually games coming out in 2016, and they have finally officially announced that Pokken Tournament is coming to Wii U in spring of 2016.
Right. That's the kind of Tekken-style Pokemon fighting game from Namco.
Yes. In fact, I believe the producer of the Tekken series is a producer on this as well.
And it was initially announced as an arcade game, but we just found out over the weekend at the Pokemon World Championships, I believe, right?
Yes, I believe that's exactly what happened. Yeah, it came out in Japanese arcades last month, but yeah, over the weekend they confirmed it is indeed headed to Wii U early next year.
Yep.
And yeah, it's a 3D fighting game. It's got you know, a lot of popular Pokemon characters in it. There's only been a handful of characters announced so far. They're going to be playable, or rather they have been shown as playable in the arcade version. And we got your Pikachu, Charizard, Lucario, Gengar, Blaziken, Weevil, handful of others. There are also other characters that just work as assist characters. But I would assume that for the Wii U release, they're probably going to amp up that roster, add in some more characters. Who would you like to see in the game?
Well, my main character in what was it? Diamond was Monferno, Flaming Monkey. So sure, Monferno. I don't know a ton about Pokemon. But I do know there's a Lucha Libre version of Pikachu in the Pokken Tournament. So,
oh, that's right.
I'll probably be choosing him just to.
Is his name just like Libre Pikachu?
I think it is. He's wearing a mask and everything.
Yeah, I would kind of like to see a Rattata in the game myself, just because I'm all about fighting rats. We got them fighting rats out there, and I'm hoping for Wailord because I think he would just fall out of the sky and, just splat everybody.
The way Nintendo's been keeping the Mega Man franchise on life support, maybe we can just hope that Mega Man appears in the game as a weird Pokemon version of himself.
I don't know how that makes any sense at all. I would, think it's more likely that we might see, Jin Kazama or something show up, but I believe Namco has already put those rumors to rest. There will not be any Tekken crossovers into this game. So what other sorts of exciting news do we have going on right now, Mr. Slate?
Well, I don't know that there's so much news here, but just really quickly, I just want to say that that I've been both enthralled by all of the Super Mario Maker videos on YouTube and also just super disappointed that apparently everyone on YouTube has this game and I still don't have it yet. there's not much more we can say at this point other than it looks like it's going to be the best thing ever. And some of the new amiibo unlocks that they've revealed really blow my mind. And in fact, some of the ones that aren't amiibo unlocks but you unlock in different ways really blow my mind, such as, mild spoiler alert, Mario in an actual cart running through a level. So pretty amazing stuff, and I can't wait to play that game. But also there's, the 2DS dropped its price to $99.
Oh, that's right, it did. I mean, if you ask me, it probably should have been that price to begin with. It always seemed a little much at $130. I thought if you're trying to get in there, get into the hands of younger kids, try to make it a cheaper option. $99 is really what it should have been when it came out a couple of years ago.
And it still comes with a digital version of Mario Kart 7 for that price.
That's a nice deal.
Speaking of Mario Kart. And, personally, I've got a new Nintendo 3DS. It does everything a 2DS does and more. I have no reason to own a 2DS. But I always thought I would like to have it just because I have every major iteration of every handheld Nintendo's ever done. Pretty much. So I'd like to add this to the collection. So I'll probably still wait until it's even cheaper. But at $99, I'm starting to really keep my eye on it.
Well, I feel like that's kind of the takeaway. If you've been holding out on getting a 2DS and you have wanted to get one, you know, maybe now is the time, now that's gone through that price
range. And also, I mean, the 3DS is at that point in its life cycle where it's definitely winding down. We're heading towards, you know, whatever its replacement is going to be sooner rather than later. But if you're one of these people that are coming in now, you know, because of, you know, with costs going down and stuff, you've got this great ready-made library of amazing titles. 3DS really does have some great games. And, you know, you can jump on board for $99 and enjoy all that stuff, especially if, you know, it's great for a younger audience. So it's not something that I think a lot of hardcore gamers like you and I will take much advantage of. But, you know, maybe I would get one for my kid.
Yeah, if you're new to 3DS, it could be pretty exciting.
Well, you know, speaking of exciting, you know, I'm a big fan of the old school NES game and arcade game Excitebike. And I don't know if you saw, but Nintendo sent out, I guess, kind of a tweet. I think that's what it was this week.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I saw that.
Kind of promoting upcoming games all week, or rather promoting eShop games. And they said it was all, you know, throughout the week they were going to be touching on this stuff, and it was going to culminate in actually they called it Builders Week, and the image associated with it was with the Minis series, the March of the Minis. And they said it's going to culminate in the release of Versus Excitebike.
Yes, they did.
But they don't say what that is exactly. Now, I think Versus Excitebike was the name used by the original Excitebike, or maybe the version in the PlayChoice arcade cabinet?
Well, it was a couple of things. It was the name of the arcade version, which you know, wouldn't really make sense when it comes to this Builders Week because they actually did not have the customization feature in there.
Right.
But also, Versus Excitebike was the name of a game released on the Famicom Disk System that really did emphasize the customization. And unlike the cartridge version, you could actually save your custom tracks. So apparently this is a virtual console game of that Japanese Famicom Disk System Excitebike. And I think, you know, pretty much by the time that this podcast is live, it'll probably be available in the eShop. I guess they haven't said if it's Wii U or 3DS. Heck, it could be both. But, yeah, that's the impression I'm getting, and we should know really, really soon for sure.
That'd be cool. I'd like to see a lot more of that, actually, the original Famicom disc games being released on Virtual Console, because in certain cases, like, for example, there was stuff that you could do in The Legend of Zelda that you couldn't, features and that weren't available in the
right, like the microphone,
version. Right, like using the microphone to scare away the Pole's voice. And then there was also the, I believe certain games had better soundtracks. There's definitely some little differences that I've learned about over the years, and I'd love to play those original versions.
So here's something cool that I saw recently. I was looking around online and saw that there is a new Link action figure coming out in the not too distant future. It is a toy based on Majora's Mask, and it is in the Nendoroid line, which, if you're not familiar with that, is this, you know, super deformed style figurines. And they've actually done a couple of these with Nintendo characters in the past. They've done some of Mario, Luigi, and they did one of the Wind Waker version of Link, which it was a perfect fit because he's already, you know, fairly super deformed style. But you know, this one's Kid Link. It works pretty well. It comes with lots of cool accessories. Comes with the Bunny Hood, Deku Mask, Zora Mask, Goron Mask, as well as Majora's Mask, of course. Plus, it has a bunch of accessories like Shield, Sword, a Red Potion, and, of course, Toddle the Fairy. So that's a pretty neat collectible. If you're interested, I would, you know, check out online retailers like BigBadToyStore.com. I think it's going to sell for about $45, and I'm probably going to add that to my collection.
Yeah, you know, I save all my toy money for Amiibo these days, but that whole series is pretty good stuff from what I've seen.
Mm-hmm. And that's not the only interesting Nintendo collectible that was announced recently.
Yeah, I don't know if I would call it collectible necessarily, but a lot of our craftier listeners out there might want to know that Joann Fabrics and craft stores are now stocking Nintendo-themed fabrics with cool images and patterns of Mario characters, classic scenes from the original arcade Donkey Kong, stuff like that. It kind of came out of nowhere today. And it's not something that appeals to me personally, but we see so much stuff, just like on Nintendo Power, we saw so many fan creations and so many amazing
section.
Things.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, you know, Nintendo stuff blows up on Etsy all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, this could really help people, you know, create some cool stuff. So, you know, definitely check that out at their website.
If I decide to pick up knitting, I, you know, should totally do it with some Nintendo fabrics and stuff.
Exactly. You know, first it was Yoshi's Woolly World. Now it's real fabrics. They really are expanding, you know, their brands and their characters to broader and broader audiences, I guess.
Wow, totally meta.
Now, I've got something. I've got something that's partly news update and mostly rant.
But it also has to do with Antenna Collectibles, does it not?
It absolutely does. Now, we all kind of, you know, lamented but accepted the loss of Club Nintendo here in the U.S. You know, it was great for like a year or two. Then there was a couple of years where it was not so great. And then ultimately it was just dead. But it might surprise some people to know that Club Nintendo is still a thing in other parts of the world.
Wait. What are you telling me? I thought it shut down in the U.S. and in Japan.
Only there, Chris Hoffman. If you lived in the U.K., you could go to Club Nintendo U.K. or whatever it's called right now.
By crikey.
Go to what they call their Stars catalog and still get all of this exclusive collectible merchandise.
Bloody hell.
And it's not just stuff that's still sticking around. They're adding new stuff all the time. Like this past week, they added like three or four new items that would have been way better than like almost anything that came out during the last year or two of Club Nintendo in the U.S. Let me just run really quick down here. Here's a list of stuff that I found in the U.K., Club Nintendo, that you can still get, presumably today. It's still listed there. A Match with Mario card game, a Kirby blanket, that Luigi's Mansion 2 diorama that was only available here for like 5 minutes, 3 Super Mario-themed coaster sets, a Legend of Zelda carrying case.
Carrying case?
Carrying case, yes.
For what?
You know, I guess it's for, I didn't write that down. I'm trying to remember. I guess it's for like a system or something.
Okay.
5 Mario Kart 7 trophies. The actual trophies.
Yeah. Like the
actual
miniature replicas of those of the in-game trophies.
From the in-game trophies. Like shiny, nice-looking real trophies. Mario Kart 8 and Super Mario 3D World soundtrack CDs.
Yeah, I would so want those.
Mario golf balls. A Captain Toad figurine lamp.
That's right.
A Majora's Mask light. A Mario Kart 8 badge set. Mario Kart 8 t-shirt. 3DS home menu themes. How hard would it have been to bring those out over here?
Yeah.
A Yoshi's Egg backpack and a Princess Peach and Luigi relaxation sets.
I don't know what that means. That sounds weird.
They're like blankets and eye masks like you'd get on an airplane or something, but, you know, patterned after those characters.
Does it actually like have like Luigi's wide open eyeballs on the mask you put over your face and you just look like Luigi staring at you?
Nothing that cool. But still...
That'd be creepy.
Exclusive free Nintendo junk that we never got over here or only got here very briefly that you could still get today at a fully functional UK Club Nintendo.
Yeah,
what's going on?
That is kind of frustrating. Hey, if you are listening to us over in the UK or other parts of Europe, lucky.
Yeah, take all your junk, put it on eBay, and don't charge too much for it because I'm going to be checking it out.
I don't think that's what I was suggesting, but yeah, something like that. No, I just it's very fortunate if you're one of the folks over there and you can get your hands on that stuff, unlike our paltry prizes over here.
Yeah. God bless the Queen. I wish I could get my hands on that stuff. Now, I mentioned before that you have been playing a little LBX.
Yes, I have. And I've put a few hours into it. Not enough to really give it a full-blown proper review, but I can at least give you my first impressions of that. And, off the bat, I would say it's all right.
So you give it kind of a eh.
It's not bad by any stretch. I don't think it's great either. It's kind of, I think what you would expect based on what we had seen so far, which is, it's very Pokemon-esque, but obviously with robots instead of, little critters. But actually, maybe more than Pokemon, it might be more comparable to the Mega Man Battle Network games. Because, in both cases, you have, this little, robotic avatar. You're going in there to do battle in, this isn't a virtual setting. In LBX, you're battling in these, miniature, like super reinforced cardboard arenas. They make a very big point of this. This LBX would be impossible with the super reinforced cardboard. It would be too dangerous to have these robots fighting each other. But now we have reinforced cardboard. This is key. But even some of the characters are a lot like the ones that are in Mega Man Battle Network. You got the fairly generic male lead. You have the female friend. You have the somewhat racially insensitive fat guy with big lips. And they all like to get together and do battle or whatever with their little robots. As I said, I'm only a few hours in, so I haven't really gotten a chance to do all of the customization stuff that's supposed to be key to the game. I've kind of been sticking to my core parts. I haven't really had much of a reason to upgrade to other stuff because your parts do level up as you play. And so, switching out to different functions doesn't really seem to be to my benefit at this point, but it could be very interesting. I'm also pleased to report that the battle arenas are pretty fun to play around with, because I know you said that was a concern you had. They looked really bland to you, but they're definitely not. There's a wide variety of battle arenas. Sometimes it's in like a canyon with a river. Sometimes it's in a city setting. Sometimes it's in, you know, a plain where there really isn't that much except for a few, you know, rocky outcrops or something like that. But there is some variety there. And, you know, there is variety in the weapons as well. You can, you know, choose between swords or clubs. You can get projectile weapons as well. So, you know, that stuff's all okay. You know, when it comes to the actual gameplay, you know, it's just sort of there, solid, unspectacular. But, you know, certainly not a bad game. There are a bunch of weird things I've encountered, though. One of the first things is, you know, you see the intro to the game. You know, it sets it up. There's, like, some battle going on in space, I guess. And, you know, it just kind of throws you into this in the intro. And it's like, yeah, you know, this is really important. The fate of the world, you know, rests on this battle. But it all started, you know, back with the LBX. And, you know, then it does this flashback to this LBX tournament, and, you know, the three main characters are there, and, you know, they see, you know, their rival, and they're like, oh, we're going to fight in the tournament, and we're going to prove ourselves to be number one. But, you know, that never would have happened if it weren't for that first day. Then there's another flashback.
It's like Inception.
Yeah, there's a flashback and a flashback, and it takes you back to, you know, starting when your main character first got his original LBX robot. The story takes off from there. And so that was strange. But the other strange thing is once I got my robot, I kind of felt that the difficulty balance was a bit off because, you know, I got my guy and I'm like, okay, you can see which characters, you know, NPCs are also battlers. You can challenge them to a fight. And so I went and fought one of them. And he was like three times stronger than I was. Like any hit he did would take off just a ton of damage on my character. And I just barely survived. And I'm like, oh, man, this is going to be a really tough game. But then as I continue the story stuff and, you know, got into some random battles, because apparently, you know, you'll be in some, you know, dangerous part of the city and you'll come across, you know, some random thugs and they'll be like, hey, we're going to fight you with little robots. And so you're forced into an LBX battle with these punk street toughs. And they weren't too bad. Those battles seemed very fair and balanced. And, you know, I leveled up a bunch. I got a lot stronger. Got my more powerful armor and stuff that you get, you know, just through story progression. I'm like, okay, I'm going to go challenge, you know, this regular guy again who I barely beat before. I'm a lot tougher now. And he still did three times the damage to me. So I don't know what's going on with that. Something seems a little off. And the third oddball thing I want to mention is that it has this weird, it seems like a free-to-play mechanic in that every time you battle with your robot, you know, your maintenance gauge goes down. And if it goes all the way down, then, like, you don't get experience points or something for winning. So you can only do this a certain number of times, and you have to go get maintenance. But I don't see any reason it exists. Like, if this was a free-to-play game, that'd be like, okay, well, now I have to wait half an hour or, you know, pay more money to get the maintenance done. But this is not a free-to-play game. You don't have to pay anything extra to do that stuff. You just have to, you know, go back to, like, the main store in the game. They'll do your maintenance. And it's like, okay, I'm back up. I can go do my battles again. So I'm just not sure what the deal is with that, why it would even be in there, other than, you know, it seems to mess up the flow of the game. I can't see why they want to stop you from battling, which is supposed to be the fun part. So that's definitely odd.
Reminds me of the mechanic you see in some games where you can break your items or break your weapons, which I always hate.
Yeah, that's always annoying.
Even when it works within the balance of the game, I'm just like, seriously, this is not fun. But, yeah, I don't know. It seems like you're just reinforcing the opinion I had that, you know, maybe for a certain audience, this game is amazing. If you can really get into the customization and you put in the time and effort, maybe.
Yeah, probably if you're already a fan of the TV show, this will.
Yeah,
know,
yeah, absolutely.
Be up your alley.
But it doesn't sound like anything that's maybe going to break out to a much broader audience than the specific types of people that this game was clearly made for.
Yeah, I mean, that was kind of my takeaway, is that it is a lot what it looks like. In this case, you can pretty much judge the game by its cover.
Hmm. Well, if you don't have anything else for news, I guess I was going to mention, unfortunately, a bit of scary news. A lot of people may have heard about took place over the weekend at the Pokemon World Championships in Boston that we mentioned earlier.
Oh, that's right. Was not cool news at all.
Yeah, essentially, in a nutshell, two guys, showed up for the tournament. They were registered for the tournament. But they had been making threats online. They'd been, already knocked off one online chat room for bullying. Apparently, they are, Pokemon fans. Apparently, at least one of the guys has won a couple of state tournaments.
Hmm.
And they went to the championship with every intention, seemingly, of competing. But they also went there with a shotgun and a rifle in the truck.
That's not good.
And
that's
they
not
had
good at all.
No, they had posted pictures online beforehand of the weapons in front of their car, kind of acting all tough, talking big. And in fact, they had already kind of made, I don't know what how serious these were, but threats against other people online.
So what happened?
Well, they showed up, and thankfully, there had been a moderator on one of the Pokemon forums that they were on and kind of talking their junk on, and they had alerted the Pokemon organization, behind the championships, who had then in turn alerted security and alerted police. So ultimately what happened was these two guys showed up at the front door and were, taken away by the cops. And the cops got a search warrant, found the guns. Ultimately, I think they let the guys go. They had been charged with not having a permit for any of these weapons. But I don't think they've yet charged them for the threats, although the investigation from what I read is ongoing.
That sounds kind of like a terrorist threat to me, man.
Yeah, and in fact, it was Boston police in conjunction with a kind of anti-terrorist task force that included some federal officers that eventually got involved in this. So they took it very seriously, apparently, and thankfully, after reading the story in detail, I mean, it sounds scary, and it is scary that they showed up with this stuff at all, but it seems tough to tell if these guys were, potential crazed, mass murderers, or just a couple of punk kids who, just like guns too much. And it's funny because they talk to people who were at the tournament, and they've been there in previous years, I guess, or were a part of that community.
Mm-hmm.
And they talked to some friends of theirs, and they were basically like, these guys always seem really nice.
Yeah, that's what they always say.
That's true. They did say that their persona online, like on Facebook, had changed in recent years. And, whereas initially one of the kids, was very had a very sweet picture up there. It had eventually turned to him pointing a handgun and things like that. And by the way, I keep saying kids, but, the youngest was a guy named Kevin Norton, who's 18, and his friend was 27. That's a guy named James Stumbo. So
you have to go and give them their minutes of fame on our little podcast, mentioning by name, huh?
Well, I don't know. I mean, that's part of the story that I read. I mean, I don't want to draw any, positive attention to these guys, obviously. But I guess the point I would make with this story is, the reason that there wasn't even the potential for anything ultimately terrible happening is that the right people spotted this and they didn't stay quiet about it. They made sure that the authorities knew and it was taken care of and any potential threat was neutralized. So, if there's a lesson here, it's if you see something that's suspicious, especially, in these communities that a lot of us are a part of, definitely say something.
Yeah, I'm just glad that it did end in a positive way and no one got hurt and, they were dealt with. And hopefully that was the end of that.
Yeah. Yeah. Scary, but, all ended well.
All right. Well, that was a little bit more serious than we like to get in the news. But we're going to have some fun with some Super NES stuff. But we will first take a little intermission and continue from there. All right, we are back, and today we are going to be talking about Super Nintendo, because just a couple days ago, the system celebrated its 24th anniversary in the United States, I believe. So tell me, Mr. Slate, what are your thoughts on the Super Nintendo all these years later?
I love the Super Nintendo. It's one of my absolute favorite game systems and game libraries. And, I think as an old school gamer and someone who really still appreciates classic style kind of side-scrolling 2D games, sprite-based games, to me that's the heyday of that type of gameplay. I mean, the NES introduced all these concepts and introduced these franchises, but still really bumped up against technical limitations a lot.
Uh-huh.
He had a lot of flicker and tear, and it just couldn't handle larger sized games. Only a certain portion of the games had true save functionality, things like that. But the SNES came in and really ironed all that out and gave us a very kind of, much smoother kind of version of what the NES initially promised. So
yeah, I'd have to agree. I mean, it feels like when they did the Super Nintendo, it was like, here's everything you loved about the NES, only bumped up. You know, it's all of the same, franchises, but without some of the limitations they had before. Everything looks better and sounds better and plays better and has a little bit more complexity. Plus, they threw in, a whole bunch of brand new ideas, new franchises, new properties, Mode 7 and all that good stuff. And, just took gaming to, really the next level.
Yeah, and they introduced a lot of new franchises. I mean, you don't typically mm-hmm. have a lot of new first party IP on systems anymore. You're lucky to get one or two. Forever, mm-hmm. Pikmin had been the last had given us Captain Olimar, which was the last kind of significant new Nintendo character. But on the SNES, right there on day one, you had F-Zero and Pilot Wings.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
So
it was a lot easier, back then. You aren't investing quite as much to make a new property, and plus gaming was still even in its infancy. I mean, you might still be able to say that now in some ways, but back then it really, really was.
In a way, from a development perspective, it was almost the perfect balance between you could make a super robust, really meaty title, like especially with the RPGs that came later in the system's life cycle.
Oh yes.
But then at the same time, you were still dealing with, compared to today's, budgets and kind of out of control, dev team sizes,
mm-hmm.
much more manageable games. You could afford to take risks. You could put out more titles a year. And of course, I'm not saying that I would want to.
Yeah, I mean, they had some great games were probably done like, 6 month development cycles with a dozen people or something like that.
Yeah.
Things like that are unheard of now. Those would be, super popular bestsellers at the time.
Yeah, and I'm certainly not saying that, that I necessarily prefer this period or this style of game to what we have today. But there were definitely some advantages that era had.
Mm-hmm.
So
what was your first experience with the Super Nintendo?
Well, first thing, at the time I was already working at Game Players Magazine, and I was probably still only 16 or 17, working there as a summer job.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe shortly after that, CES came around, which is the show they used to have. Well, they still have it for all personal electronics.
But right, but back then, that's where all the video games were.
It was, yeah.
Off.
Basically, what we know as E3 today used to be part of CES.
Mm-hmm.
So, I was low on the totem pole. I didn't get to go to those shows. But a guy I worked with went and came back, and he was just singing the praises of Sonic the Hedgehog.
That wasn't a Super Nintendo game. What are you talking about?
Now, see, here's the thing. Sonic the Hedgehog had debuted at the show, and the way that Sega debuted it was they put Sonic the Hedgehog, running off of Genesis, shown on a, CRT on a table. And right next to it, for comparison's sake, they put Super Famicom, which had just become available in Japan,
mm-hmm.
Before the SNES came out over here. And they had Super Mario World running on it. And mm-hmm. essentially it was like, the message was, look how much better Sonic looks. It's so much faster. Blast processing, yada, yada. Mario doesn't look any better than it did on the NES.
Did they really coin the blast processing term back then?
I'm not sure if that was probably, they called it something else before
doesn't
you got
matter,
to it.
Doesn't matter.
So anyway, my friend saw this at the show, and he was, one of the higher ups there. He came back, and he was just like, basically, screw Mario, it's over. Nintendo embarrassed themselves showing this game that didn't look any better than Mario on the NES. And Sega's the wave of the future.
The story is not going the way I expected.
So I'm thinking, I was kind of disappointed. I'm, a huge Mario fan, but at the same time, I'm excited about this crazy new Sonic thing. We finally get in a Super Famicom. Another guy at the office orders one from Japan. We got it in, and I convinced him to let me borrow it over the weekend.
Mm-hmm.
So I took it home along with Final Fight, Super Mario World, F-Zero, and Pilot Wings. And let me tell you, that was like the best weekend ever. I just sat in my room, I remember it's like it was such a sunny day outside. Instead of being a normal kid wanting to play outside in the sun, I was like, this is such a nice, picturesque, sunny day outside my window to play Super Famicom next to. And I just kept plugging the, you know, swapping the games in and out just all weekend, loving them all a lot. And Super Mario World, I shouldn't have worried at all because it was amazing. To this day, it's as much my favorite game as any game I've ever played.
Oh, my.
And, you know, in fact, oftentimes
that's a lot of praise.
When people have, like, you know, put me on the spot and I have to pick a favorite game, I usually pick that one. And you know, I finally eventually got to play Sonic, and I liked it fine. But let me tell you, Sonic has not been – or history has not nearly been as kind to the original Sonic the Hedgehog as it has been to Super Mario World. So that guy who told me all that foolishness was crazy.
Well, I don't think I'd agree with him, but I'd say the original Sonic still holds up pretty well.
It's no Super Mario World.
Play it on your 3DS. Download 3D Sonic the Hedgehog. It's still pretty darn good.
You know what you can find if you run off the beaten path in Sonic, if you know where to look?
Extra lives.
Coins. Shoes.
There aren't even coins in that game. You don't even know what you're talking about.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Go
rings.
Back to the Mushroom Kingdom.
You do know Sonic was built because Yuji Naka was playing so much Super Mario Brothers, and he used to challenge himself by running through the levels as fast as he could, and that was somehow the inspiration for Sonic.
I conducted that interview with Yuji Naka, I'll have you know. Me and Mr. Thomason.
Yeah, so anyway, I'll quit my Sonic bashing now. But yeah, that was just an amazing week. Sonic, Super Mario World was by far my favorite game that weekend, but I really enjoyed Final Fight and Pilot Wings and F-Zero. And especially, I mean, the Mode 7 stuff was so fresh. You'd never seen anything like that. You know, the ability to zoom in and out and give you that pseudo 3D effect was really one of the, you know, went on to become the one of the defining kind of elements of the system. And also the sound. I remember when first played Super Mario World, and you get to the first level where you're in an underground area and you hear that cave echo.
Mm-hmm.
And that was one of the things that, you know, when against the competition, against the Genesis, really gave the SNES an advantage.
Well, I mean, the sound and the graphics, too. It could do way more colors on screen at once. So, mm-hmm. You know, it makes these really, really vibrant-looking games.
Now, what about you? What was your first SNES experience?
Well, I mean, my first SNES experience probably would have been, you know, reading about it in Nintendo Power magazine. But when it comes to actually playing it in person, you know, I think I probably went down to the local video store, and I was, you know, kind of friends with one of the, you know, employees there who was probably, you know, a college student or something like that. And you know, he would tend to, you know, tell me when new stuff was coming out and maybe set aside, you know, Genesis games or whatever for me if he knew there was one I was waiting for and it was going to be hard to get. So I remember going down there and, you know, they had a Super Nintendo that they hooked up on the TV. And I think I played a little Super Mario World, which was fantastic. And I played a little F-Zero, which was a lot of fun until I wiped out and exploded, like, before I completed my first race. And I'll tell you, I actually never played F-Zero again. I retired as an F-Zero competitor.
I'll tell you, I loved it when it first came out, and
after
I even managed
dying
to,
like that.
I even managed
horrible,
to beat it.
Embarrassing fashion.
I beat it back in the day, but that game has aged super poorly. I don't even know how. I can barely take a turn or two in the game if I play it now.
It requires a little bit of practice, yeah. But really, what stood out to me is that, you know, at the time of the year that this came out, you know, obviously it's the end of August. You know, school's about to begin. I'm not sure that's really the best time for releasing a new system, really. But, you know, I went back to school, and I had a friend there named Jimmy. And, you know, I certainly did not get my Super NES, you know, day one. I had to wait a while. I couldn't afford that. And neither could he. But he had a birthday coming up that's, like, at the end of September. So during that first, that 1 month period, what we would do is, you know, he knew he was getting a Super Nintendo from his parents. So what we would do is, while they were still working, you know, we'd get off of school, we would go over to his place, we would take the Super Nintendo out of, like, the attic or something, take it out of the box, hook it up to the TV, and I don't know how, like, he took out games without his parents noticing that, you know, oh, the shrink wrap is off and the boxes are a little bent and folded now. But so we would do that. So we'd take the stuff out, we'd, you know, go back to his place, and we'd play it, and, you know, I remember him being like, you know, I've been playing ActRaiser. I can't beat it, Chris. You got to come over here and play ActRaiser and help me beat it. And so we actually beat ActRaiser before he even got the game officially from his folks.
I would have loved to have seen him try to, like, play innocent when he finally got it on Christmas.
His parents probably knew, but they probably just didn't care. They were fairly lenient parents. But, yeah, trying to be, you know, all sneaky and, you know, pull a solid snake to play Super NES was my first real substantial memory of that.
I then when it finally came out in America, I drove like to the next town over because none of the stores in my area had it like on launch day.
Oh.
And I went and bought a SNES at, I want to say it was a Babbage's, like maybe even an hour away from my house. And I bought Super Mario World, F-Zero, and Pilot Wings. And I think that was pretty much all that particular store had, except for maybe also Populous. So picked all that up and still replayed all of it, even though I'd spent time with the Japanese versions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I did finally get a system myself on Christmas of that year. And yeah, it was a lot like what you were saying, you know, just playing, you know, all these different games as much as I could. I mean, I didn't have, you know, quite that many. I got, you know, Mario World, of course, along with Gradius 3 and Final Fight, which both came out pretty darn close to launch, if not at launch. But, you know, those were really my type of games. Final Fight was one of my favorite arcade games because, you know, you're a politician who eats trash. so that's always a lot of fun. But, yeah, I was basically doing the same thing. I'd play through Final Fight. I'd play as far as I could in Gradius. You know, I'd play through a world in Mario, and I'd, you know, switch out to something else. And, yeah, that was just such a blast.
You know what really stands out to me also as kind of a favorite SNES memory is when Street Fighter II came out.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I mean, obviously, that was a huge exclusive, and especially mm-hmm. because, you know, SNES came out, was it even like a year later after the Genesis? It was a long time after the Sega Genesis came out.
When the system came out?
Yeah, when the SNES came out.
It was almost 2 years after the
Holy
Genesis.
Holy cow.
So the Genesis already, you know, had built up all that momentum in that time. And, you know, Sonic the Hedgehog had come out, you know, a couple of months before the Super Nintendo made its debut in North America.
Yeah, it didn't seem like Nintendo expected Sega to be any kind of competition because
no, they didn't.
They hadn't been in the previous generation. The Master System got trounced by the NES. But they gave Sega all that time, and Sega, you know, made some smart moves, like you
uh-huh.
said.
In fact, here's something that Nintendo did back at the time, and I apologize if I've mentioned this on the podcast before, but, you know, I was really excited about, you know, what, you know, I saw in the magazines is this thing called the Super Famicom that, you know, was before they announced it for the U.S., of course. It looked really cool. I saw the Genesis also looked really cool, so I wrote to Nintendo. I'm like, hey, do you guys have any plans to release the Super Famicom in North America? And they basically told me no, they did not. I'm like, all right, I'm buying a Genesis.
God, that's typical Nintendo. Like, you know, if we're not ready to make an official statement, then we will just pretend this other thing doesn't
exist. Yeah,
I mean,
it was probably, you know, the PR marketing talk, we have no plans at this time sort of thing. But as a kid, you know, all that means is, nope, it ain't happening.
And also, that was in a pre-internet era where,
right.
you know, that kind of information didn't spread out to as wide an audience as you'd expect. So Nintendo probably...
I was getting my information straight from the source. It was straight from Nintendo telling me they're not bringing this thing out over here.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I totally went with the Genesis. But anyway, this all leads to, you know, a couple of years later, then, you know, Street Fighter II comes out.
That's right. And, you know, it was a huge exclusive for them. I think, you know, Sega Genesis would eventually get its own Street Fighter game, and not for a while. Mm-hmm. But the SNES one had, you know, for a home version, it had really great graphics.
Yeah, and the whole warping floor visuals. It was, you know, really groundbreaking. Some of the arcade game had, but it's like, oh, can the home version do this? Yes, it can.
And younger generations of gamers, I mean, it's hard to explain what, you know, how different kind of the times are now. But back then, you know, arcades... And arcade gaming was a huge, huge thing.
Well, yeah, and the dream was arcade perfection. If you could say a game was arcade perfect, that's like, wow.
Right.
It's like I'm getting this entire arcade machine right there in my living room hooked up to my TV.
And it was in the arcades where some of the biggest gaming franchises got their start. Street Fighter, and then you look at some other games that eventually...
that's why I was a big Genesis fan, because of Altered Beast and Golden
right.
Axe. And eventually with the Super Nintendo, Final Fight, you know, that was one of the big draws for
also,
me.
Also, two of the other big defining games of the 16-bit generation would be Mortal Kombat, NBA Jam.
Those
all started
in the
arcade.
That came quite a bit, or I guess a year after Street Fighter really made its splash.
Right. But just the idea
that... was a huge defining moment.
The idea that the king arcade game was coming to this one system, and it wasn't arcade perfect, but, you know, for those days, it was close enough and looked great, And I just remember going to Toys R Us to get that game and seeing, as I walked into the door, seeing somebody else walking out with the game and just thinking, oh, man, I hope that wasn't the last one. And then, like, you know, picking up the pace through the door.
Mm-hmm.
And then going over to a friend's house. And I was never the best Street Fighter player, but me and my friend would just sit there and just, you know, play matches endlessly. And it was the first real fighting game you had on a home console. Like today, you could just put in Smash. You could put in, you know, any number of Tekken games. You know, any kind of fighter. Street Fighter, obviously, now, mm-hmm. what it's evolved to. But back then, Street Fighter II was like the first real home fighting game. And,
well, how dare you? How dare you say that in the face of Urban Champion?
Well, I can't say that my friend and I spent endless hours playing Urban Champion. So maybe someone else had a different experience.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Urban Champion was a pile of bunk. But yeah, Street Fighter 2 was fantastic, and that was one of those titles actually that my college age friend at that video store set aside for me. I remember calling up because they only got like one case, had like six copies of the game in it, and I'm like, hey, do you guys have Street Fighter 2? And they're like, oh no, we're all sold out. And I'm like, this is Chris. Do you have any copies of Street Fighter? He's like, yes, I do have one for you. Right down there, and got it like on day one. It came out like right around my birthday or something too, so it was perfect.
Nice. And, speaking of these types of arcade fighting games coming home, and I mentioned Mortal Kombat earlier, that was one of the SNES's most notorious stumbles, is when Sega Genesis and SNES both got Mortal Kombat, but Genesis left in all of the extra violence and the fatalities, mm-hmm. where Nintendo really tried to sanitize it, and there was a huge backlash.
That's right, it had all the sweat or milk or whatever you want to call it instead of blood.
And in the back-and-forth kind of battles that the Genesis and the SNES had in those what's probably the most significant, quote-unquote, console war there ever was, mm-hmm. Street Fighter II coming to SNES first and Genesis getting the superior version of Mortal Kombat were two of the biggest moments that really swung the pendulum one way or the other.
Those are huge battles in the console war, for sure. Also, though, I have to say, blood and milk and sweat aside, the Super NES version of the original Mortal Kombat did kind of suck. The controls were kind of sticky, unresponsive. So it had some other issues as well.
It did. But let's be honest, the original Mortal Kombat is a pretty crap game all around. You really just bought it for the shock value of seeing the blood, and the Genesis was the only version that had it.
This is pretty much true. Now, I know I've mentioned this on the podcast before, in that one of the most memorable moments with the Super NES for me was when Nintendo did this tour at like the local college. And I was not in college at the time. I was much younger than that. I think I had to ride my bike over there or get a ride from my parents or something like that. And went over there and they had all these unreleased games on demo. That was where I first played like Smash TV and I think Super WWF WrestleMania and also The Legend of Zelda: Link to the Past. And just getting to play all that stuff early before I was in the industry, it was a really, really exciting time. And I recall you telling me that you had a lot of fun with The Legend of Zelda before it came out in the U.S. also, right?
I did. I got my hands on a Super Famicom version, and I believe we had modified our SNES to be able to play Super Famicom cartridges, or maybe I had just used our Super Famicom. In any case, I basically played through that game in Japanese before I ever got a chance to play the U.S. version, and then I played through it again in English. But that was just, back in those days, there was a pretty long time. I mean, you still get it occasionally, like Xenoblade Chronicles X for Wii U has already been out in Japan for quite a while, and we're only just now going to get it basically at the end of this year. Mm-hmm. But a lot of times we get simultaneous releases, or usually releases are at least somewhat close. But back then, like you said, there was like a super wait between the Super Famicom release and the Super NES mm-hmm. release. And that was kind of the norm with games, which is strange when you think about it, because it wasn't like they were story-heavy or had cinematics or lots of dialogue that needed to be localized. But we would
you look at the way that localization was done back then, and it often seemed like it was a very, very tough task to perform.
Yeah, I guess they didn't know how easy they had it.
But still, Legend of Zelda, can't wait on that.
No. I mean, for almost every Zelda, even up to Wind Waker, I would always buy the Japanese version, at least play partly the way through it before I got the U.S. one. So, yeah, I remember the strongest image that comes to my mind when I think of playing that game back then was, the forest week at the Master Sword.
Oh, yeah.
And just the colors they had, and they'd never seen that kind of vibrant green.
It wasn't a vibrant green. It was this very foggy, muted, environment where it was really showing off, some of those, I don't know if they were really transparency effects.
Yeah.
They were essentially transparency effects.
On multiple layers.
Yeah.
But then when you get the sword,
mm-hmm.
then
right.
the fog lifts and you get the nice green.
Yeah, it was. The fog lifts, the animals, are all dancing through the forest.
And that was, that scene was actually.
Shines through.
And that scene was actually the box art on the Japanese version. It was the place in the forest where you get the Master Sword. Mm-hmm. And I remember the Super Famicom boxes actually were much smaller and, in my opinion, a lot nicer.
Were they? I thought they were about the same size, but they were just, vertically oriented, basically take the box and turn it up on its side.
You know, that could be true. Yeah,
I just remember
they were much, they were different than your normal boxes. But maybe it was just that the way they oriented the box art made them look like they had a different shape.
I mean, maybe they probably were just a little bit smaller, but not by a, it wasn't a vast amount. It was more the orientation that was the big thing.
That was something I used to always appreciate.
Yeah, that was a great game and a great moment.
Yeah, when every new system would come out, I would always be like, oh, what do the boxes look like? You know, I was excited about every little aspect, so.
Yeah, one last memory that really stood out to me when it comes to Super Nintendo was a bit later in its life cycle, in around in 94, 95. There were a couple games that I really wanted to get my hands on, but back then they didn't really have firm release dates. You couldn't just go onto Amazon and do a pre-order and get your game to show up right away. So it was just a lot of calling and checking to see what was going on at the local toy store or video game store or whatever, software, etc. was the what GameStop was called in my town back then. And, if the game was sold out, then you were just kind of out of luck. So I remember, driving like 40 miles to the next town over to pick up. First, it happened with Illusion of Gaia, and then with Killer Instinct, where I had to make these lengthy drives out to pick up these games. And I think that must have been, right when I got my driver's license or something, because I was definitely driving. But, I'm glad I didn't get pulled over.
The things we do
for
Nintendo
games. I did get the
games.
I got the games. I was able to get them. My Illusion of Gaia even came with a limited edition shirt. Killer Instinct was more for my brother than for me. He was really into that franchise. You love doing the combos.
I remember when I was at, I guess this still would have been CES, but I get confused about when it switched over to E3. And, at this point, by the time Killer Instinct came out to the Super Nintendo, it had already been on the arcades and N64.
Mm-hmm. And not on N64. What are you talking about?
It hadn't been? It wasn't on N64 before it came out on SNES?
No. In fact, it never came out on N64. It was supposed to. It was supposed to be a launch title, but there was a bunch of delays and stuff. And then we ended up getting Killer Instinct 2 on the N64. It was known as Killer Instinct Gold, but it was a part of Killer Instinct 2. But, it was due to all these delays and things. And so it ended up coming out on Super Nintendo first. Obviously toned down a bunch from the arcade game. Here I'm giving a little history lesson to someone who lived it.
But my memory is really bad. But the part I do remember is, obviously, in any case, they had already shown the game, the original version of the game. And they had also, at that time, they were really touting the Silicon Graphics, computers that were being used to make these
graphics. This was about Ultra 64.
Right, when it was originally called Ultra 64. And I remember sitting in the audience next to a guy. This was at Nintendo's, traditional annual kind of presentation, which wasn't nearly as, flashy as it is, as the presentations get these days.
Uh-huh.
We're still sitting in the audience, and I happen to sit next to a guy from Silicon Graphics. And he says, wait till you see this game. I can't believe they did it. He's like, I can't believe they did it. And they finally ultimately show Killer Instinct running on Super Nintendo.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, it looked, let's be honest, like an assy version of Killer Instinct. I mean, all they did was they just compressed the images down more. I don't know what really impressed this guy so much. And then, of course, they eventually released an even crummier looking version for Game Boy. And
perhaps
I just
B. Orchid's pointy parts poked his eyes out.
Possibly. And then, like I say, when they released an even crappier version for Game Boy, the first thing I thought of was that guy, and I thought, his mind must be absolutely blown that they got this game on Game Boy.
Perhaps so. So let's get down to what's really important here. The best games on the system. What would you say the top games are for you? Let's go through and just pick out our top five. So let me tell you, I've been thinking about this, going into this podcast. It's really, really hard to come up with five games.
Well, this is one of the best.
I mean, only five games.
This is one of the best libraries of any game system, period.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like I said earlier, it took like all the best stuff from the NES and made it all, arguably better, and then add all this other stuff in. It's like, man, how do you choose?
Honestly, don't think I could. I've got a top three. But I don't think I could even make it to five. I just don't know how I would put them in order. I have so many
favorites.
That
doesn't make any sense to me.
Well, I have a top. I can name my top three
only
games.
Only three good ones. I can't quite make it to five.
No, I mean, I've got too many. I don't know how you'd put them in order. Like, I could give you a top 50.
Well, that's what I'm saying, is it is really, really tough.
Yeah.
And, you know, probably 25 games come to mind instantly. But we're doing a podcast, so I think I'm going to somehow try to narrow it down and go through my top five.
All right, you want to go first, or should I go?
Well, I will go with my number five game, and I'll let you give your number five game. How about that?
Okay, I'll try.
And, you know, this is subject to change. Any other day of the week, I might come up with different titles because, oh, man, narrowing this down is really rough. But for number five, I will say it is Mega Man X.
You know, that would be one of the games I would have considered for somewhere on my top five, but I just wouldn't know where to place it. But that is an amazing Mega Man game.
Yeah, I mean, as you know, I'm a huge, 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 huge Mega Man fan. And, you know, we didn't get classic Mega Man right off the bat. We finally did get Mega Man 7 a few years later, but we started with Mega Man X. Even that was a few years into the Super NES life cycle. But, you know, it added a whole bunch of new elements. It added the wall jumping. It added the armor parts that, you know, sort of let you get new powers and, you know, customize. I mean, you weren't really customizing. Everyone ended up with the same Mega Man in the end. But, you know, felt like you were, you know, customizing the character a bit.
It was almost like a small smidgen of RPG that you're able to kind of, you know, find these new pieces that
keep. It was exploration, because that stuff was usually off the beaten path. And you'd learn these new abilities and be like, oh, now I have a headbutt. I can smash through a ceiling in a couple of spots.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, find a place where the path splits and find a hidden power-up. And, yes, you know, you'd be able to find health boosters and stuff. Or, you know, a heart container that would make your permanently extend your life bar. So, yeah, I guess you could call it RPG-like. And, you know, of course, it was a little bit darker as well, which, you know, at that age, that was sort of, you know, the perfect sort of thing.
And he seemed a little bit older. He didn't look as like, you know, the chubby kid Mega Man. He was a little bit cooler looking.
Yeah, I mean, it's not supposed to be the same character. It is supposed to be someone who is, you know, the 100 years later, another generation of Mega Man, so to speak. And, yeah, it was also just had that very same exciting, well-controlling play mechanics. Replaced the slide maneuver with a dash. But in a lot of ways, it felt much like the original, but looked great, looked better, and was a heck of a lot of fun. So I will say that is my number five title.
I support that. My number five, I'm honestly going to pick one here at random from a list of really good games. And I think I'm going to pick one only because I know it won't be on your list, because it probably wouldn't make most top five lists. But it is a favorite of mine.
This sounds like nonsense to me.
It's Super Punch-Out.
Oh, all right.
I mean, it's essentially just a prettier-looking version of the same Punch-Out that was on NES with mm-hmm. a couple of new features. But it is my favorite Punch-Out game, even above the more recent Wii title. And that was another one I saw at CES first, and it came out of nowhere. I saw, like, a big demo area for it, and I had no idea that game was even being made. So mm-hmm. I always kind of look back on that game as just a really great surprise.
That is a fantastic game. And you're right, it is not in my top five, but it is, you know, like in my top, you know, 10 or something probably. Yeah, lots of fun. Added, you know, some new play mechanics with that little gauge for your power punches or whatever it was called.
Right, which they brought back in Smash Brothers.
Yeah, it didn't have, you know, the star uppercut thing, but it had its own unique play mechanics. You know, fun, interesting, mildly offensive characters and things like that. But my favorite, here's my story about that game. For that one, you know, I was really looking forward to it, really excited about it, you know, really wanted to give it a try when it came out. And so, but, you know, I couldn't afford to go out and buy it. But I found out that the video store had it, the local Blockbuster, I think, or maybe it was Hollywood Video. And so I wanted to go out and give it a try. I'm like, well, it is kind of pouring rain right now, but, you know, I got to go out and borrow that copy of Punch-Out. So I decided to do that. I went out in the rain. I was riding my bike through the city to get to that video store. And I was tearing through downtown. And I'm going past the courthouse. And some dude just steps out in the middle of the road. And I can't put on my brakes fast enough. I just crash into this guy. I crash right into him on my bike, and I flip over the handlebars. And he was like, I think came out of a donut shop. I think he was like getting donuts to take him to the courthouse or something. And I'm just flying through the air. There's donuts flying everywhere. And, you know, I land on my face in the middle of the road. And it's not as bad as it sounds. I think everyone was okay, except for the donuts. He was okay, even though he was heading to or from a courthouse. He did not try to sue me. I was not hurt, but I got back on my bike after I made sure he was okay and went off to the video store and got it.
Neither rain nor physical harm will keep you from Punch-Out.
That's right.
I appreciate that dedication.
But it is not on my top five. However, number four, I'm going to say Final Fantasy VI.
Hmm.
Or Final Fantasy III, as it was known at the time. And I hate having to explain that every time, so I try to never explain it. Because I'm like, that was 20-something years ago. We shouldn't have to explain that anymore. Just call Final Fantasy VI and be done with it.
I have the same problem. I never played VI, which is, I know it's a crime. Most people think it's, or a lot of people think it's the best NES game. But I did play.
Person.
I did play Final Fantasy II, which in Japan was Final Fantasy IV, and I really loved that game. I don't know why I never got to VI, but I same thing. I have to explain to people. When I played it, it was called II, but you might know it as Final Fantasy IV.
Yeah, Final Fantasy VI was really the first RPG that I got into, and it had really really detailed graphics. I loved all the different characters. It was really cool, the part where it has the branching storylines that really gave everybody a chance to shine. The fact that they all were so unique and had, these distinct abilities. And, of course, the plot is really nuts, where basically, halfway through the game, the good guys fail. The bad guys, literally destroy the world as it had been. And speaking of bad guys, Kefka is, one of the all-time great villains, this, psycho clown guy. He's just fantastic as, an evil, sinister dude who's, causing all kinds of, behind-the-scenes political machinations there in the Capitol. And, really fun storyline. A fantastic soundtrack, too. That was also the first video game soundtrack I ever bought after experiencing that game. Had to get the soundtrack. I think Squaresoft at the time. And I think there was a coupon for it in the inside the box. And I think it was called Kefka's Domain, and I had to go and get that. It was really expensive, as I recall. It was almost as much as a full game, probably $40 or $50 or something. I'm like, man, that's super expensive, but I got to do it.
And the Squaresoft name takes me back. They used to be near Seattle, Washington, near Nintendo, right?
I think so.
And I visited there once, in their old office once. And my one little story is I went there because I was working on a cover story for Game Players for Secret of Evermore, which was actually being developed out of that U.S. office.
Yes, which was partially developed by former Nintendo Power writer George Sinfield.
Oh.
He was a writer on that game.
Oh, nice.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe he was there when I went there.
Probably.
Anyway, the thing that I remember most about that trip, even more than the game, which looked, great, was that, bunk beds were built into the cubicles. And the moment you sign up for a job and you get to your desk and there's a bed is molded into it, you're in for a long development cycle.
Mm-hmm. Pretty crazy. While we're telling stories, I guess I'll mention that after I played Final Fantasy VI, I did also want to go back and play Final Fantasy IV or II. And the way I did that was I went, again, to the local video store. This time I did not run anybody over, but I just ran it from the video store, and I almost literally played it nonstop for 3 days, beat the game on a rental, remember almost nothing of it, but that was a good time too.
It's
your number four?
My number four, I could say Contra 3 The Alien Wars. I could say Super Castlevania 4. F-Zero, Pilo Wings, they haven't aged as well, but I love them back in the day. But again, almost just grabbing one at random, the one I'm going to say is Super Mario All-Stars.
Oh.
It's a little bit of a cheat because they're all obviously remakes of NES games.
Also lets you pick four games at once.
It does. But it did introduce the Lost Levels for the first time, which is, people should know, is the original Japanese version of Super Mario Bros. 2. And for years, those were the versions I would go back to when I wanted to replay those games because they just looked so much better. And, you know, more recently I'll play the NES games for nostalgia. But man, it's hard to beat that pack. You know, we haven't seen a lot like that from Nintendo since. You know, that many great games kind of refreshed, packaged together. It was an amazing cart.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, back then, it was really, really cool to see a 16-bit enhanced version of some of your favorite games. And I really wish they'd done it with more stuff. You know, I'd always hoped they'd do it with Zelda and Zelda 2. It was even cool when they did it with Tetris and Dr. Mario and put those on one cartridge and enhanced the graphics up to 16-bit spec. But, yeah, there was a lot of stuff they could have done that with. But even with just Super Mario All-Stars, yeah, that was excellent.
And those All-Stars, versions of those games went on to, in a way, become the de facto versions of those games for a while, because when they re-released them as the Super Mario Advance series mm-hmm. on Game Boy Advance, it was those versions from All-Stars.
Mm-hmm. Except for Super Mario Brothers 1, the original. That All-Stars version has never been re-released in any form, as far as I know.
Oh, yeah, now that you mention it. Maybe it was, because,
of course, on the Wii disc compilation, because that was just a straight ROM dump. But, yeah.
Maybe it's because they had, not too long before that, released Super Mario Brothers DX on Game Boy Color.
They did that. They did the NES Classics game as well. So somehow that one ended up slipping by.
Hmm.
I think because of that, Lost Levels never made it into another form either. But, yeah, as far as Mario 2 and 3 go, yep, you're totally right.
Hmm.
For my number 3 game, I'm refusing to say what my number 3 game is. I'm going to jump to my number 2 game.
Oh.
My number 2 game is Chrono Trigger.
Ah, yes. The game that you keep bashing me over the head for never having finished, even though I keep picking it up and then putting it down again.
Because I don't know why you hate Chrono Trigger and refuse to finish it.
I actually really like it.
That just celebrated an anniversary. Just celebrated its 20th anniversary, in fact, just a couple of days ago. So 20 years of Chrono Trigger.
It was the Dream Team collaboration between Square and Enix, which, before they became the same company, used to be kind of, I would guess you would categorize them as friendly rivals. Mm-hmm. One side had Dragon Quest, one side had Final Fantasy. They were the two biggest names in RPGs.
But yeah, it had the Toriyama character designs. It had Yuji Horii working on the script. It had fantastic music composers. Uematsu did a little bit, and that's where Mitsuda made his debut, and he did most of the score on that game, and it came out utterly fantastic. But yes, it was a dream collaboration, like you said, and it just took RPGs to places that no one really thought of back then. I mean, being able to visit the same location in various time zones, being able not time zones, time periods, different eras, being able to go to the future and the past, and even to the further past, the prehistoric era, and in some ways, the things that you did didn't change a lot, but it added a lot in terms of side quests, and sometimes, as far as the story goes, it would result in a big change, but that time travel element was just a whole lot of fun. And, it stuck to the basics. It didn't try doing anything really unusual when it came to, the magic system. It was like, oh, you level up, you gain new abilities. It was very easy to grasp. Used the same active time battle system as Final Fantasy had been at the time. And made it, very, very pick up and play. A fairly small cast of playable characters. Only 7 of them. But they each had, very distinctive traits. You weren't kind of overwhelmed by your choices. It was just like, which one is best? Which character do I like the most here? And, of course, they had those team-up attacks, which did add a bit of differentiation and variety and made it stand out apart from other games. Plus, it just looked gorgeous. The fact that it didn't have random battles, but just had these scripted battles. The enemies would show up at sort of predetermined points. There were these invisible trigger points on the path. It just did stuff a little bit differently. In a way, things that make it seem way more modern and ahead of its time. These days, everyone hates on random battles, but scripted battles, they're probably not quite so much against.
But, I missed Chrono Trigger back in the day, which is probably why I don't have an even deeper appreciation for it. But I've been trying to work my way through the DS re-release.
Mm-hmm. That's probably the best version.
And I do really appreciate it. I do enjoy that game, just maybe not as much as most folks. I will finish it one day.
Well, if you need some pointers, you know who to call.
All right, I'm going to get to my third, number three game.
Okay.
I'm going to try to, we're getting a little bit long here, so I'm going to try to get through it pretty quick. But and my top three are really close, especially number two and three are really close together. But my number three is Super Metroid.
All right.
Best version of one of my favorite franchises. Although, actually, maybe that's not true. Super Metroid, I'd probably have the most nostalgic love for, but Metroid Zero Mission might be my favorite Metroid. Mm-hmm. But
still, Super Metroid, fantastic. And it, to me, is really going to put the series on the map big time.
It's really hard to go back and play the original NES Metroid because it didn't have the save functionality was really rough with passwords, mm-hmm. and it didn't have a map.
No map.
It's hard to imagine a Metroid game or a Metroid-like game these days without a map, but it didn't mm-hmm. have one. Super Metroid was the first one that had the map.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, took when I was, you know, I was on Game Players at the time, so I did a cover story on that game, and which involved me having to make a whole feature where I found every little thing in the game and made a huge map of it all.
Drawing a map, or are you taking photos of the screen, stitching them all together?
I was stitching them together, but it wasn't the it was of the map screen, so it wasn't like of the actual gameplay environment.
Oh, okay. So that's not so bad.
I just stitched together a completed map with all the stuff showing on it. Mm-hmm. But even that took me forever. And mm-hmm. but even having done all that work on it, like you talked about before we talked about in the past when you worked on the Zelda Twilight Princess guide, you'd think that having played a game that much to do the work, you know, would decrease your enjoyment of it.
Yeah.
But no, I didn't get tired of that. I still go back and replay that game. It's pitch perfect.
Mm-hmm.
It's
so atmospheric too.
Yeah. I mean, it gets everything about Metroid exactly right. It really is the blueprint for any other 2D Metroid that they should ever make. They should always kind of look back at what went right with Super Metroid.
Mm-hmm. You know, part I love is the part where you're fighting that big red monster and you have to knock him back into the pit of acid.
Yeah.
And after, if you don't know that you have to knock him back, it can be a really frustrating fight. But then you finally do and you beat him. You take him out. Like, okay, on to the next area. And then he shows up and he's still alive. Like, oh, God, what do I do? And it looks like he's just going to totally murderize you. And then he just melts into like a pile of bones. It's so cool.
Right. And then the cool secrets in that game, like, those two little aliens you can find and help escape, mm-hmm. that they're totally optional. And then the surprisingly emotional ending, you know, where the baby Metroid comes back and saves you from Mother Brain. And then, of course, the classic Metroid, you know, escape from the exploding base. Just so many great memories from that game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it shames me to say that's not in my top five.
You can no longer talk bad about me for anything if Super Metroid is not in your top five SNES games.
I mean, I guess it would be number six.
Not good enough.
But, yeah. Boy, where do we go from here? Do we go with, do I go to my number one or your number two? Or, well, they're probably the exact same game, aren't they?
Well, you skipped your number two, didn't you?
I did.
My number two, I'm going to guess, is your number one. My number two is The Legend of Zelda, A Link to the Past.
Exactly.
What can you say about this game? They had went off the rails a little bit with Zelda 2, which was a great game, but mm-hmm. so different from Zelda 1. They brought kind of the overhead view back of Zelda 1 mm-hmm. in Link to the Past.
Back to basics, pretty much.
Back to basics, but the dungeons were so much more involved, and there was so much more to the world, and it was just so colorful and pretty.
There was actual dialogue.
There was the light world and the dark world.
Mm-hmm.
And is there any more iconic beginning to a game than in this one where you wake up in the rain and your mm-hmm. uncle's gone off to the castle? And
yeah,
you have to
I think
him.
I mentioned when we did our retrospective on Zelda several weeks back that that part would always give me chills and goosebumps on my arms every time I saw it. Yeah, it just did everything that you want out of a Zelda game. And I don't want to belabor the point because we've talked about many times before, but it is fantastic. It is my all-time favorite Super NES game.
Would you say it's your all-time favorite game, period?
I certainly have said that in the past. No pun intended.
All right, now we're left with my number one game, which I think is your number
That would, yeah.
Two games.
Today, it would be my number three. I said Chrono Trigger was number two.
Right.
So I guess this is my number three. But any way you look at it, it's, you know, one of the best games ever made, one of the best platformers ever made. And, of course, we are talking about Bubsy and Caw's Encounters of the Furred Kind.
I just never got tired of collecting all that yarn.
No, wait, that's totally wrong. It is Super Mario World.
Which was, you know, it came packaged with the SNES, and as far as I'm concerned, remained throughout the system's life and to this day the best SNES game that was ever made.
Well, I can't quite agree with that. It's my number three. But
it's debatable. But since Mario is my favorite
really
franchise.
It's hard to argue it too much.
Yeah.
It's a spectacular game, you know, really built upon what Mario 3 had done. Add up, you know, this whole, I mean, it really led up to the name, Mario World. It really felt like a big, wide open world instead of being broken up into these, you know, distinct level chunks. It was just this huge open map. And of course, you know, added things like Yoshi, brought back the Koopa Kids, you know, added the Cape.
It's still, in my mind, the best map of any Mario game, the best world map.
I agree.
And it, something about it, I'm trying to think if this is really true, but it feels like so much more could be discovered in that map, and so much, and maybe it's because they were doing this all for the first time back then, but you really didn't know exactly what all the rules were. You didn't know necessarily when you started playing that game that you could find alternate exits to certain mm-hmm. levels and open up entirely new paths on the map. And, you know, they've brought some of that back with, for example, with the most recent new Super Mario Brothers titles, mm-hmm. The side-scrolling ones. But even in there, when you open up a path, it's more like, well, here's a dirt path to another dot. But back then, it would, like, redraw parts of the map.
Yeah, suddenly a hill would go down, or another hill might pop up, or yeah, this whole trail might pop out of nowhere and go doo 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 doo.
Yeah, and, or you'd go to these one-off levels that were weird. Like you'd go to a ghost house that had a giant Boo, which might be the only place where you saw that, or you'd go mm-hmm. to this one level that existed only just to offer you lots of power-ups,
mm-hmm.
Including a Yoshi.
Oh yes, everyone's got to remember that secret level behind the ghost house in World 2.
And some of the things they would require you to do, there's that one, this is the thing when I replay this game I always have the most difficulty with, is that one level where you have to
go under the gate, is that what you're
going to
say?
Go under the gate using the cape. You have to fly under the gate to get to the second secret gate, which
yeah.
opens another level.
That part is tough.
And then the whole, you know, on top of secrets, you would find your way to the Star World.
Yeah, the Star Road.
And then eventually from the Star Road, you could go to the Special Zone.
Mm-hmm.
Which had hidden classic Mario music and all sorts of bizarre things.
And that could lead you to that secret back passage, so to speak, of Bowser's Castle.
Yeah, I think especially when you're thinking about strictly 2D style Mario games, it's by far the most secret filled Mario there is.
It definitely feels that way.
More recent Mario games have had less to do with kind of exploration and secret discovery and more about just straightforward platforming skills. But that game really felt like rewarded you for not just playing, you know, a platformer, but for always kind of peeking around maybe in the direction that it felt like you weren't necessarily being guided toward just to make sure there wasn't something over there.
But it didn't seem overly sneaky either. It just felt like it hit that balance, you know, perfectly, perfectly well, as it did in so many other regards, you know, with the sound and the visuals and the gameplay. Just nailed everything just about perfectly.
Yeah, I guarantee you at least 50% of all the levels I'm going to make in Super Mario Maker are going to be with the Super Mario World theme.
All right. Pretty cool. Well, there's you know, no way to you know, argue that the Super NES was a great system. We might not have the exact same list of top five games. But, yeah, so much good stuff on there.
Yeah, and there's so many games we didn't even get to. I mean, the list goes on and on.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't even mention, you know, freaking Final Fight in this context. ActRaiser, Earthbound, TMNT 4 is one of my all-time favorites. So I'll just, you know, give a quick shout out to those. Anything on that you would feel horrible leaving out?
I don't know. I'm sure I'll think of something as soon as this is over. I wish I was at home and I could actually look at my collection and remember everything that I had. But I'll just give a blanket statement that the SNES, I don't know what I would necessarily say at this moment is my favorite Nintendo system, but it's hard to say that system wouldn't at least be in the running.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
You know, and we didn't even talk about the fact that it added shoulder buttons to game controllers.
That's right.
You're welcome, every system that existed after SNES.
Well, this has already gone on quite a bit. So I think we better wrap up this episode. But first, we're going to have a dramatic reading. This time, from the back of the NES game, Cowboy Kid. Sheriff Sam and Little Chief are coming to town in this delightful Western adventure. Cowboy Kid is a two-player simultaneous action adventure for the entire family. Cowboy Kid has 4 megs of action packed into this NES cartridge. Players must learn to be appointed sheriff so they can rid the West of this scourge of evil. Can you bring these dudes to justice? Billy Morgan, the Mad Brothers, Coyote Jim, the Scorpion Master. Wild Wolf Chief, / Joe, Keith. Cowboy Kid rounds up arcade and adventure action for the wildest showdown in the West. Beware, rustlers, there's a new sheriff in town.
I'm going to think that Keith is probably the biggest badass because he doesn't need to advertise all that extra macho nickname flair.
Well, he's no Scorpion Master, I'll tell you that.
All right, well, that's it for this week. As always, you can find us at powerpros.podbean.com, or you can follow us at PowerProsPod on both Facebook and Twitter. Also, Hoff's Twitter handle is at Chris the Hoff, and I'm at Chris Slate, even though I pretty much never post. Hoff also has a really great blog called Still Playing with Power, which you can find at christhehoff.tumblr.com. You can email us for any reason at powerprospod@gmail.com. And as always, we really appreciate it if you can take a second to drop by iTunes and, you know, say something nice or drop a nice rating, only if you feel we've earned it, because it really gives us a nice chuckle and allows other people to discover the podcast.
Thanks for listening, everybody. For myself, Chris Slate.
See ya.
And our friend Lucina.
The future is not set.
We will see you next time.
Hello, and welcome to Power Pros Podcast. I'm your host, Chris Hoofman. I like Mega Man and shirtless dudes eating out of garbage cans. That's all I want to play all day long.
I'm your co-host, Chris Slate, and all I want to do is play Nintendo Land.